Welcome to Phoenix Cinema Podcast. I'm Chris Austin.
And I'm Luke Parker.
And this is a podcast where I can absolutely say we do not use AI to enhance our accents in any way. And it's also a place where we discuss what's showing at the historic Phoenix Cinema in North London. And this week we are discussing Brady Corbett's new film, The Brutalist. This will be a 3.5 hour episode as we attempt to dissect every single thing about this large epic film. But don't worry, we will have a 15 minute intermission, so don't feel too overwhelmed. Okay, I will launch into the overall plot here. Escaping post-war Europe, visionary architect Laszlo Toth, Adrian Brody, arrives in America to rebuild his life, his work, and his marriage to his wife, Erzsébet, Felicity Jones, after being forced apart during wartime by shifting borders and regimes. On his own in a strange new country, Laszlo settles in Pennsylvania, where the wealthy and prominent industrialist Harrison Lee Van Buren, played by Guy Pearce, recognizes his talent for building. But power and legacy come at a heavy cost. Well, awesome. What did you think of this movie, sir?
Well, I kept putting off going to watch this film, mainly because of that chunky runtime. You know, it is a little bit intimidating. But I'm so glad I went to go see this film. And for me, it's definitely a film you have to watch in theatres if you can, 100%.
Yeah.
And for me, it was definitely one of those great defining theatre experiences. So much to unpack. I will say that a common theme amongst films of this runtime, especially those that are kind of split into two halves, is I found that the second half lacks, and it doesn't deliver in the same way the first half does.
That's so interesting, yeah.
But in this film, they feel the two halves, they just feel so distinct, and it feels like they're both trying to achieve such different things that wasn't really an issue for me, which is interesting because from the reviews that I've read, a lot of people have had issues with the second half of this film. Because the first half is absolutely incredible. It's nothing glaringly original. It's just painting a picture, you know, of the American dream and building up the American dream. So it's nothing original, but the craft is second to none in this film. It's consistently impressive. And then the second half comes along and it just chips away at everything that the first half has built.
Ooh, you know, chips away.
Someone said it best on a review that I saw, and they said the first half is building the American dream and the second half is them bringing a sledgehammer to it.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I think that sums this film up perfectly.
Sorry. So you mean intentionally so, not in a first half is better than the second half kind of way?
No, intentionally so, for sure.
Sure.
I mean, I think the second half was just as great as the first half. But yeah, I mean, they're my initial thoughts. What about you?
Yeah, you know, it's really, I'm glad you said that because I never really paid too much attention to the two halves almost being separate from each other. I kind of just saw it as one whole experience with an intermission in the middle. And yet there is definitely a shift, like immediately, as soon as he's met, you know, his wife and they're having dinner or lunch and there's some tension at the table. Overall, I really enjoyed this. It's a very large film. There's a lot going on here and there's lots to think about and unpack, But yes, I agree with you. The filmmaking is amazing. The score by Daniel Blumberg is fantastic.
It's incredible. It's I can't even put it into words. I've been listening to it all day at work.
And really?
Yeah. It almost, the main theme, it's not even a main theme really. I don't even know what to call it. You know, the opening credits, and you're kind of teased with this brass fanfare, little motif, and you think it's going to go into something big, something epic, something powerful, and then but the score just falls into something really abstract and alternative, and it's an incredible piece of art standing on its own.
I'm glad you think so. Yeah, it's super impressive. It's super impressive. Yeah, but I was kind of confused initially because it begins with the promise of an overture. And so when I see overture, I expect to sit there and just listen to some score for a few minutes.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but instead we hear the note of that main theme and then we're straight into picture. And I was like, huh? Okay.
That was definitely unusual, for sure. I did notice that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, it's so, like you said, unique. And my favorite track, actually, in the album is called Steel. And it's the lead up to the intermission. And I think that the way we reach that intermission as a cinematic presentation is absolutely masterful. That is using cinema to its full potential. The montage, the way Blumberg builds his score, the voiceover, and the voiceover is talking about a picture, a very significant picture that has been found, and then the lights up as the final notes of the score hammer out and the picture comes on screen with a timer of 15 minutes for our interval. I'm sorry, that is pure cinema.
Yeah, it felt a bit weird for me. This is the first time I've ever sat through an intermission during the theatre.
Okay.
You know, obviously, as we know, that doesn't happen very often. But
no, I mean, it's second time for me after The Hateful Eight.
I never saw that in theatres.
Ah, okay, yeah.
I thought it was a bloody great idea, though. You know, it was such a well-needed break.
Agreed.
After what was a very intense first half. And having that little moment to just gather yourself and reflect on what you've seen and just take a minute away, it really did favors for the second half, I think.
Honestly, I couldn't agree more. It was, yes, it's so well placed. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't ever feel like, you know, because the daunting thing about The Brutalist is its runtime. And at no point in that first or second half was I fidgeting and thinking, oof, you know, what time is it now? Not at all. So when we reached it, I was like, it's almost like an achievement. You go, fuck, okay, we've done it. We've done the first half. And I didn't pee, not once. I didn't go to the toilet once during the film. I only went in the intermission. So I am, like, as a personal achievement.
Yeah, that's great. You know, super, you didn't miss any of that.
I didn't miss any of it. And I honestly felt like I couldn't miss any of this.
Because every scene, every interaction, every word felt important. And so if I had to go pee during the middle of one of the halves, I would have been furious.
Yeah, and I'd be devastated, yeah, because I'm thinking, what have I missed? What crucial line or glance even a look have I missed?
And I went to see this on my own as well, so I couldn't even, you know, lean over and be like, what
to have
what
a little,
happens?
Yeah,
yeah.
Fill me in.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you think of the performances in this movie? Anyone stand out for you?
Yeah. Adrian Brody was incredible, you know. It just felt so real, so passionate, and in my opinion, this actually blows Ralph Fiennes out the water from Conclave.
Interesting.
This is my new favorite, I think, of the year, of 2024, for sure. And this film was shot in, like, a month or two?
Really quick, yes.
How is that even possible?
Yeah.
That must have been so intense and so difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he doesn't... I don't think he really shines. He's good in the first half, but he doesn't shine until we start to reach those real internal conflicts, you know, those real emotional scenes of the second half, all those dramas. That's when he really shows what he's capable of, I think. But yeah, consistently great throughout.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, it's typical of Adrien Brody, really. But I say typical as if we should expect it. But honestly, we do. He's such a great actor. Mm-hmm. And it is a typically great performance. I was also really struck by Guy Pearce.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exceptional performance, honestly. I mean, he can play this sort of buttoned up aristocrat, powerful, wealthy man, affluent socialite so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he commands the screen. He really does. I mean, it was, yeah, he was great. He was great.
Yeah, totally agree. Especially that very first scene with him in. It's just a shock, you know? He comes in so loud and such a glaring presence.
Yes.
But after his first appearance, you think he's gone. You think that's it, you know? I don't actually think I even realised it was him at first.
Really?
You know, in that first scene, we see him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, those two, absolutely fantastic. And also as well, I will say that speaking in turn, that goes hand in hand with Daniel Blumberg's score in a way as well, but the opening and closing credits are so unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
They really stand out. The whole scrolling across the screen.
Yeah.
And to open with at first, I love that. And that's taken on its own iconic, mm-hmm. you know, life all of its own now in this award season. And then the end credits, where it's sort of going diagonally across the screen from, you know, from bottom left to top right. I was like, interesting. And that final scene as well. What did you think about, without going into spoiler territory, mm-hmm. it ends on the tone just shifts dramatically. And
are we talking about the epilogue here?
The epilogue.
Yeah. You know, at first, as I was walking out the cinema, I didn't really like how it finished, you know. Mm-hmm. I understand what they were trying to do, and it was a great way to kind of sum up and push the thematic and core of the film. But when I first went out of the cinema, I just thought that was a bit cliche. But now I've had time to think about it. I think it's a really nice ending, actually. I think, like I really? Said, it managed to sum everything up. And if it went on, you know, for like 15, 20 minutes after we just sat through this 3.5-hour film, I probably would say something different. But amazing music as well. That's my favourite track of the score is, I think it's called Venice. It's the very last track in the score.
Is it the one that's very like poppy and
very 80s? Yeah.
Yeah, is that, I think it's great.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Oh, I didn't even...
Because it's like a variation on the on that main theme.
Oh, I didn't even realise that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's... What's the word? You know the word, what I'm talking about, where it's like within the scene where everyone can actually hear it, or it's like music that only the audience can hear.
Yeah. What's it called? this is going to bug us now. It's, you know what? It's going to come to us. It's just going to hit us. Yeah.
But yeah, so I think there's two tracks that play. One that's kind of within the scene, and then there's one that's only we can hear, and that's Daniel Blumberg's part. But yeah, the reason I did like it is because it was, it was short. You know, it was like the cherry on top of the film, I think. You know, if it went on any longer, it would have felt too much. But it was a really beautiful way with the niece to be there with her voice, who's obviously, even though it's never really spoken of or addressed, you know, the fact that the niece is mute for like the early years of her life. It's really nice for her to be there and like conclude the film. I think it's quite touching.
Yeah. I'm still unsure about that ending. I'm not sure that epilogue was necessarily needed.
That's totally fair. I can see how it could be hit or miss for some people. And like I said, at first I wasn't convinced either.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? I mean, since I saw that ending, I've, you know, reading reviews and reading about the movie, I see what the take is on that. And I'm like, okay. I had to read about it to sort of understand what they were going for. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's, to what you were referring to earlier with the two halves, there's a lot about the second half of the film that, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed it. But by the end, there's a lot that feels unresolved here. So many character relationships go unresolved. And then we enter this massive time jump. And I just want to know, hang on, wait. How did we get there? Yep. You know, Guy Pearce's character, his exit from the movie is so ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I thought it was great. I thought it was really great. I mean, that whole final scene, like Felicity Jones's final scene, is wow.
Powerful. Yeah. Wow. Really wow. Intense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I do agree with you, though, that there are parts of the film that are unresolved. And it feels a little bit unsatisfying, I think. That is the main issue I had with the film. And again, I don't want to give spoilers, but the main one for me is there's kind of something that's teased between the niece and Guy Pearce's son. There's like a moment where it's...
Yes. Yep.
Kind of suggests something happened between them, mm-hmm. but it's never clear mm-hmm. and it never comes up again.
Mm-hmm.
And like throughout the rest of the film, because this happens pretty early on in the second half, I'm thinking, what happened? When is this going to come back up? But it never does. Yeah.
And it never does. Yes. And I actually think that there are many things that happen in that where it's like there are so many threads. You know, we could potentially go this way, that way, that way. And sometimes it's just a closed-ended thing. You know, I think personally for me, it was the use of the heroine and introducing, you know, Felicity Jones's character to it when she's in. I was wondering where that's going to go. And it sort of, it didn't go anywhere in term on a character level mm-hmm. that was satisfying for me. By the way, diegetic.
Ah, okay.
That's what it is. That when music is also heard by the characters as well as the audience. Diegetic. I had to Google that as we were talking. but yeah, no, I don't know. You know what's so funny, Luke, is that since when I watched the film, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think there's so much to admire about it. As time has gone on, the more I thought about it, I have lessened. You know, my thoughts have lessened somewhat on it.
Interesting.
Because I think to what you were saying, ultimately, it's not for me entirely satisfying on a character level. And maybe I just never quite felt moved while appreciating so much about it on a technical level. The building of the structure itself that's taking place is just, I mean, you look at it and you're like, look at this. It just looks magnificent. I do think the film slows down quite a bit once we get into the whole building of this structure. But to be honest, there's so much to take in here, even on a historical level. It's just a lot to digest. It's like a really, really, a meaty book, like a novel, you know?
Yeah. And again, I think I said this about the last film as well, but I'm almost surprised this wasn't adapted from a novel. And I'm surprised
100%
that Laszlo Toth, the main guy, at first you kind of think this is based on real life.
Who was this guy? Yes. How is Laszlo Toth not a real person? How is this film a work of fiction? That blows my mind. That's quite remarkable. Because, yes, it feels like a true story based on a book or a memoir. And they do such a good job of really making this feel like a life that's just been adapted as best as possible onto the screen. That's the biggest compliment you can give this movie.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that was quite glaringly fictional was the building itself, because it's just, I mean, it's incredibly impressive, but also kind of ridiculous at the same time.
What do you mean?
Well, this massive, big, brutalist architecture church on the top of a hill in the middle of nowhere, basically. That's, you know, a gym, a church, a library, and a gymnasium.
Not a library, a public reading space. yeah. Okay, yeah.
But apart from that, like, it felt so real. So real.
Yeah, honestly. And you know what? This is a really interesting thing as well. I am falling more and more in love with period pieces by the day. I'm becoming less interested in the modern world that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting the fact that some filmmakers refuse to make modern day films, like Robert Eggers, for example. I think I read this quote from him the other day. He was doing an interview and he said, if he had to film someone with a mobile phone in their hand or a modern day car, that makes him want to throw up. And I think that that is so interesting. I also heard someone saying once that so much of the drama and tension and conflict in any story you tell is kind of robbed by our modern technological standards today. You know, you watch movies in the past where you're like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? And it's like, well, they would just use their phone. Mm-hmm. You know, the smartphone is usually the be all and end all, the start of and the end point of everyone's problems.
I never actually thought about that, but I had a similar thing recently where I was reading a book and it was a novel, and they started talking about like Instagram, and I was like, shut up, I don't want to read about this. I don't want to read about them using social media.
Right.
And it really took me out of it, interestingly enough. But I totally agree with you, you know, in terms of maybe it's because they feel like more of an escape, and because they feel more distant to the life that we lead, it feels like more of an interesting story.
That too. Yeah, that too. And it almost feels like a reset, and it's like, oh, okay, this is how things used to be.
Yeah.
And I think our modern day life can become so stressful because this is our present, right? We have to deal with our modern day politics. We have to deal with our current situation. And so, yes, I think you're exactly right on that. It's nice to, how far of a, if we're going to escape, how far can we make that remove?
Yeah.
You know, so if it's not fantasy or, you know, a whole other genre, sci-fi, then let's go back or forward. Lastly, I mean, I mentioned this as a joke in the intro, but what do you think about the fact that AI was used to help touch up the Hungarian accents? Did you know about that?
I did not know about that.
Yeah, so apparently released, that has been leaked or released somehow, and it's apparently, you know, people are now speculating. There are people that are major up in arms against it. There are people now speculating that this may hurt Adrian Brody's chance at getting the gold statue.
And Felicity Jones as well, right? Wasn't she nominated Best Supporting Actress?
I'm not sure, but yes, most probably. But, you know, The Brutalist has probably received probably the most amount of awards nominations. But knowing that now, I mean, does that affect your opinion of the film in any way? Does it not?
I will say that in general, I do hate the use of AI in any art form. Mm-hmm. I think it's just strips back everything that makes it worth consuming. So actually, to be honest, a little bit, yes, it has kind of lessened my view of the film a bit. Not enough to say that I didn't love it, because I did love it. It was it was a fascinating time. It's been quite a while since I've watched a film that I was this zoned into, this leaned into.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a little disappointing to hear you say that. Yeah, I don't really know, to be honest, because I did think that, wow, their accents are really, really good, you know, and I just thought it was a testament to them as actors. So, yeah, I don't know what to think about that, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you know, when I read that little factoid, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really mind, because it's not like the actors weren't doing the work. They clearly were, right? Because we watched it. And their performances are still impeccable. Mm-hmm. And I think, I actually wonder if the actors even had a say in that. You know, if that kind of decision, that's a post-production decision right there. And maybe, I also agree with you. AI and art is a very touchy subject right now. And I don't like where people want to take it. Maybe this is an instance where it's being used as a tool to enhance a certain aspect of performance, but without detracting from the work that the actors did. I am like, you know what? Even if this fact is now out there, I still think the actors are absolutely brilliant. Whether it will affect their work, you know, them receiving an award or not, God, that I guess that's down to their peers and the awards bodies. I hope it doesn't, because I don't think that should be a part of the conversation.
I guess it's hard to say as well, because we don't actually know how significant the difference is.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
If it's just like a little fine tuning here and there, then it's less of an issue, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and actually I recommend listening to the A24 podcast. They did an episode where Adrian Brody is talking to Jason Schwartzman, and Jason Schwartzman is talking about, I believe, his work in the movie Queer, and then Adrian Brody's talking about his work on The Brutalist. And so he talks about his process a little bit and behind this, and it's a really interesting conversation. I recommend that.
Cool. Sounds good.
All right. I mean, again, a movie like The Brutalist, we can only barely scratch the surface on something like this. But pairings, did you have anything in mind?
I did, and I feel like it's a bit of a basic bitch choice, not gonna
lie. That's fine. I'm that person, so.
So I'll go first. My pairing was, prior to watching this film, at least.
Can I guess?
I think, yeah.
Is it After Sun?
No, that would be a stretch. I'd be impressed if you could link these two up. So prior to watching this, it was my favourite Adrian Brody performance, and one of my favourite performances, full stop, and that was for The Pianist, 2002 Roman Polanski film.
Mm-hmm. Never seen it.
Oh man, it's heartbreaking. It's gut-wrenching stuff. Yeah. So he plays a pianist. This is during World War II, and this is, I think it's in Poland in World War II, and it's just about him trying to evade Nazi persecution during World War II. So it does feel like there's some similar themes, especially to the first half of The Brutalist. I think like there is quite a similar tone to the film as well. Pianist being much more harrowing, though, obviously, because of the mm-hmm. subject matter. But yeah, the main reason for this pairing being just these absolutely phenomenal performances from Adrien Brody. He's such a talented actor.
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought I'd seen it, but I hadn't. Recently, I watched the movie called The Piano, I think it's called.
Oh, with the Michael Nyman score.
Is that it? Maybe? Yeah, it's a Jane Campion-directed movie. Yeah, it must
Sam
be
Neill.
That then.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah. That's the one. So yes, no. I always get them confused for obvious reasons. Actually, as part of Adrien Brody, I think like his promotional tour for the movie, I didn't watch it, but you know, you come across these things, images, clips, headlines, and someone has shown him a clip from The Pianist of him playing a piano and or something like that. And Adrien Brody himself tearing up at rewatching that clip back. And so, yes, so, you know, this is being compared very positively to that movie. Yeah. So,
I think I know exactly what scene that is. And it's one of the most beautiful scenes in cinema is where I'm going to explain it because it's just incredible. But Adrien Brody, he's walking through this like war-torn city. It's all completely ruined. And he goes into a house and there's actually Nazis in there. And one of the Nazi senior officers finds him. And instead of persecuting him, he says, "Play me a song on the piano." And it's a really beautiful Chopin piece that he plays. And then instead of, you know, persecuting him or getting him in trouble, he basically says, "Wow, I'll let you go. That was beautiful." Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, I'm gonna have to watch this at some point.
Yeah, you definitely should. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to gear myself up for it. I think because it sounds a little harrowing.
It's heavy. It is heavy. Yeah.
Did he win an Oscar for that? Or...
I think he did. I think that's what his one Oscar was for, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, that would make sense. Okay. Yeah. I mean, cool. Lovely.
What about you?
Well, I went for something kind of the opposite, something that's really lighthearted. And it popped into my head when I was watching this movie. And it's something that when we both worked at the National History Museum together, you came into work one morning and after our morning briefing, you looked at me and you were like, "Amen."
Oh, Lilies of the Field.
Yes. Lilies of the Field.
Interesting.
That's the movie I've gone for, 1963, directed by Ralph Nelson, starring Sidney Poitier. We watched this movie in film club together. I believe it was Leone who chose the movie, and we loved it. And yeah, the reason I chose it is because just like the construction of a building and what that entails in terms of the work put in by a community and the significance that it takes on for who it's being built for. And in Lilies of the Field, it's these nuns, right, that believe that Sidney Poitier's character has been sent to them by God to build them a chapel. And it's another movie. So it's another movie about the construction of a place. It has a wonderful score by the legendary Jerry Goldsmith. And it's a much lighthearted movie. It's very warm. And it's... I thought, let's do something that's the opposite to this, for lack of a better word, brutal film.
Yeah.
And so, I've gone with that. I think it would make for a nice, interesting sort of juxtaposition.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great pick. You know, I totally see it now where you're coming from, but I would never have put those two together in a million years.
Right. Yeah. Well, great. All right. So that's a very interesting triple feature. Yeah. Maybe I would suggest save Lilies of the Field for the end so that it ends on an uplifting kind of moment. Yeah. Excellent, excellent. Awesome. Well, all right. That was a blast, man. Yeah. I look forward to the next one. And thank you again for your time, Luke, as always.
And me. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening, everybody. A special thanks to Phoenix Cinema, as always. Our music is, as always, by Stefan Krieger. You can find more of his music on stefan-krieger.com. And as always, Noah Anderson is our superb editor. If you like this podcast, spread the word, please. Rate it, like it, subscribe to it. That would be much, much appreciated. And then after you've done all that, go and watch another incredible movie at the Phoenix Cinema. Because clearly, as you can tell, they're only programming incredible movies. So go do that, and I'll see you then.